The following recording by the LA Sound Posse was done on October 17th of 2005 at the Barrick Museum Auditorium in Las Vegas, Nevada. The talk, titled Waters, Rivers, Dams, and Development, Sustaining Freshwater Ecosystems and Meeting Human Needs in the 21st Century, was given by Patrick McCulley of the International Rivers Network.
The title of my talk, Water, Rivers, Dams, and Development, it's a big title, brings in a lot of different aspects of relationship of human society and the natural world and how we manage our water supplies, but it goes much more beyond that. My organization, International Rivers Network, as Matt says, we work especially to oppose destructive river development projects, which are mostly our large dam projects, and to promote sustainable and equitable alternatives. Sometimes people see that as being a very narrow, even an arcane thing to be interested in. Dams seem to be maybe not central to human endeavors, but actually because of the very many things dams are built for, the very many impacts they have upon society, that working on dam issues also means we work on water policy, we work on energy policy, we work on human rights issues, we work on development policy more broadly, we work on the policies of the big institutions like the World Bank, policies which include not only water, energy, so on, but also things like access to information, resettlement policies, or health policies. So it's not that we're particularly obsessed about putting concrete in rivers, but this is the lens through which we impact many other development policies. And we hope that we are able to approve development policies more generally and improve the lot of especially poor people and river ecosystems by working on this issue. Enough about IRN. So, very obvious thing, water is essential for life. It's sort of obligatory to start a talk about water with saying something like that, but I think it is worthwhile to emphasize that when we're talking about water, it is essential for all life, and the management of water is absolutely crucial for the continued existence of human society and for natural ecosystems. And because water is so important, the way that we manage water also has a huge impact on the natural world. And something else is very apposite for tonight. Rain is the mother of all water. Often when you read hydrology textbooks or see presentations by mainstream hydrologists, especially hydrologists or water resources specialists working for development establishments, a lot of the discussion will be about water that's in rivers or aquifers or lakes. And it's presumed that that is where water is. But talk about it a bit later. It's very important to think more broadly and to realize that rain is where it all starts, and rain is an essential part of the water cycle. It's pretty amazing to see how 97.5% of all water is salt, and the amount of water in rivers is only 1.4% of all the water there is, so it's a tiny amount, and the amount of water that's actually available for human use or even for use to freshwater ecosystems is a very small proportion of the total amount. Conventional hydrology normally deals with the visible liquid and what ecohydrologists, well, there's a new emerging discipline, maybe it's not quite at the stage yet of being a discipline, but a stream of thought within hydrology which calls itself ecohydrology, and its concern is to go beyond looking at what they term blue water to also looking at green water, which is basically an invisible form of water, which is in the soil, which is in plants, which is in us, in our bodies, and in the atmosphere. And sort of the key difference between blue water and green water is while blue water flows downwards, the way we conventionally think of water, green water actually flows up, and this is a water falls as rain. It then is passed up through plants or evaporated from the surface of the soil and back up into the atmosphere. And you see that the amount of green water is actually almost twice as much as the amount of blue water. And this is not just statistically interesting, academically interesting, but when we come to look at where are we going to get the water to be able to feed people, provide water for people for coming generations, we got to look at the green water. So looking at blue water, what is roughly estimated to be acceptable for human use is about 12,500 cubic kilometers. Already we're withdrawing about 4,000 cubic kilometers, so almost a third of all the water that would be accessible to us is already being used by humans. Now, of course, ecosystems also need water, and you can say humans need ecosystems, so we need ecosystems to have water. And the problem with so much water being used by humans is that it's leaving less and less water available for ecosystems, and increasingly freshwater ecosystems are coming under great strain. And the great majority of water that's withdrawn from rivers and aquifers is used in agriculture, especially so in arid places. Obviously not Las Vegas an exception, but in California, the great majority of water is used in agriculture in places like India, Pakistan, Egypt. In many parts of the world, it's over 80 or even 90%. The actual municipal and domestic water is a very small percentage, 9%. If you include just water that's actually used by households, it's actually a very small portion of the total. So when we talk about a water crisis and the implication that we're running out of water, we're not going to have water to drink, that's not really the case. There's plenty of water there. The amount that's used for drinking domestic use is tiny. It's really water for food, which is the key thing. Another interesting thing is this little sliver here, 5%. I mean, a little sliver, but a lot of water is consumed by reservoirs, and that's basically water that evaporates from reservoirs. And having reservoirs like Lake Mead or Lake Powell in the middle of desert areas, you get huge evaporation rate. So what's the status of rivers worldwide? It's pretty bad. 60% of the world's rivers now estimated to be moderately or severely impacted by dams and diversions. Well, now, actually, over 45,000 large dams being built in the world's rivers. One impact of that is that some rivers now rarely reach the sea, and the Colorado is one of those examples where the delta of the Colorado has basically been killed by the water development in the U.S., and so what reaches the Sea of Cortez is a little bit of agricultural runoff from the lower delta, but basically the water that would have sustained what was an incredibly productive delta is now used in Las Vegas and Southern California and so on. And the same thing is happening in some of the other world's great rivers, the Indus, the Nile, and the Yellow. About 500,000 kilometers have been altered for navigation, so channelizing, embanking rivers, especially for barge traffic, and this has been a huge impact in, well, especially European and U.S. rivers, and the Mississippi is the most obvious example of that. In terms of water quality, this is worsening in regions where there's intensive agriculture and large urban industrial areas. It's generally getting worse. In some places, like in parts of the U.S. and in Europe, we see big successes in cleaning up polluted water, especially in urban areas. But the issues of agricultural pollution are still not being addressed, and that's still worsening just about everywhere where there is intensive agriculture. One big reason for terrible impacts on water quality is in developing countries, 90% of sewage is untreated. Much of that sewage goes into rivers with horrible consequences for the river and for anybody, of course, that's dependent on that water for drinking. Status of watersheds, we're also seeing a lot of impacts on the land that drains into the river. Urban sprawl, of course, intensive agriculture, deforestation. One figure, half of the world's wetlands lost in the 20th century. Areas like California, it's high. California, it's about 90% of the wetlands that have lost, mainly because the Central Valley was one of the world's most productive wetland areas and has now been, of course, mainly turned into agriculture. Aquifers are getting depleted, so the groundwater is being sucked out faster in many places than it's replenished by the rain from above. Eventually, this means that the water table sinks and it gets harder and harder to get water from the ground. Often the water becomes more contaminated. Some places become saline. And you have in some areas, especially coastal areas, sometimes have to be abandoned because the saline water gets into the groundwater and that's the main drinking source they have. And some of the impacts of all this is increasing floods and droughts. And we see worldwide a pattern of worsening floods and droughts. And no doubt part of that is due to climate change. And certainly we're already seeing the impacts of climate change, but also it's because of mismanagement of watersheds. Status of freshwater biodiversity. Well, not surprisingly, given the impacts that we've had upon the river and the watershed, that the species dependent on these ecosystems these habitats are not doing well. A really disturbing statistic, the freshwater species populations halved worldwide between 1970 and 2000. That's based on taking a sample of like 200 different samples of freshwater ecosystems around the world. And this is greater than any other major ecosystem type in terms of greater loss of species. Worldwide, about 20% of freshwater fish are threatened, endangered, or extinct. And in North America, the consequences are, if anything, is more serious. Interest, the extinction rate of U.S. freshwater species estimated at 0.5% of all freshwater species lost every decade, which is a similar extinction rate to you see in tropical rainforest regions, where most people are much more aware of the seriousness of biodiversity loss. And of course, not only are we destroying our natural world, our rivers and watersheds and species live in them, but we're not doing very good by ourselves either. Basically, a very large proportion of the world's population doesn't have access to decent clean water, doesn't get access even to sanitation. Consequences of that, many people die, 800 million people undernourished. We really failed to provide what are supposed to be the benefits of development or even just a decent, healthy life to a very large proportion of the people on the planet. Who are the large big dam builders being? Well, this figure, 47,700 estimated large dams in the world, and almost half of those, surprisingly, is in China. That's mainly because during the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward, there was this huge effort at just throwing up dams all over the countryside, mainly for irrigation. And these were large dams, but not very big dams, mainly between 15 and 30 meters. And they're also one consequence of throwing these dams up in such great haste was that they were very poorly built, and a lot of them are now collapsing. You see the U.S. is second. Why do we build dams? I mean, essentially we build a dam to store water. There's two main types of dams. Most dams are storage dams, which means they're built to store water. And there's another minority of dams are what's called run-of-river dams, and these are mainly for hydropower, sometimes for irrigation, and they only store a very small part of even the daily flow of the river. But it's a big storage dams, like Hoover Dam, which are the majority of the world's dams and which have most impact on ecosystems. The main purpose of dams is irrigation and then hydropower. And many dams, of course, have multiple purposes. Now, because the purpose of a dam is to store water, and it's basically to even out the flow, the reason why Hoover Dam was built was because the Colorado River was either in flood or it was drying up to a trickle and there wasn't enough useful water there for people to get it when they want it. And it's the same around the world. Rain falls very erratically, and the drier the area is, the more erratic the rainfall is, and there's really no such thing as average rainfall. It's hugely variable in time and in space. So you build dams to average out that variability and to create what for us is a reliable, dependable flow. The problem is just about all our ecosystems have, these all freshwater ecosystems have evolved based on variability, and they have evolved on the basis that the rain and the river is variable, that you have high flow periods and low flow periods. You sometimes have extremely large floods. You sometimes have droughts, and species are adapted to that. And by trying to even out that system, that's really where a lot of the problems with dams come. Biodiversity impacts dams specific. The change in flow patterns and river forms is often the most significant. Generally, people think of, they think of the impacts of a dam as, well, you create this big reservoir, so you flood this huge area, and that's the ecological impact. People don't really see that downstream, actually, the impacts can be much worse, and whereas upstream, you flood maybe even for the bigger dams, a couple of hundred kilometers, a couple hundred miles of river downstream for many hundreds of miles, even in some cases, 1,000 miles and more, you can impact the river ecosystem because this natural pattern of high and low flows is not totally wiped out. It's very severely dampened. And what's called the flood pulse, so this pulse of flood water that comes during a big flood and covers the floodplain, is extremely ecologically important, especially for fisheries, so that when you eradicate the flood pulse and you have a dam that's built for flood control and you stop the normal flood, you will have an extremely serious impact on the productivity of the floodplain and the floodplain fishery. We also, of course, block migrations is also an obvious thing, and we know from, I mean, it's quite famous, the impacts upon salmon in the Pacific Northwest and California of building dams. But this is not just upstream, downstream, it's also across the river, because where you have, it can be terrestrial species that can no longer cross the river in their migration because it's replaced by a reservoir, or it can be species which once migrated across floodplains or from the floodplain into the river, and when the normal floods don't happen, that part of a life cycle is no longer possible. Also, many other changes in the river water, temperature, salinity, pH, and so on, all which affect the riverine ecosystem. Last thing is very important, changes in sediment flows. The seriousness of this being brought home to everybody by Hurricane Katrina, and large part of the reason for the huge loss of wetlands in Louisiana and the Gulf of Mexico is because so much of the sediment that once flowed onto those wetlands and during flood events is now trapped behind dams, especially up on the Missouri. And so there's actually a lot of areas around the world that are suffering a lot of coastal erosion because of so much sediment that's trapped behind dams. Social impact's a pretty stunning figure. 40 to 80 million people worldwide physically displaced, evicted from their homes by dams during the 20th century. A lot of the statistics I use come from a report by the World Commission on Dams. I'll talk a bit later what that was. I had earlier calculated 30 to 60 million people, so it's on that order of magnitude. Nobody really knows because there has been such a sloppy accounting of how many people have been evicted and what has happened to those people. And so not only are these people facing the trauma of eviction, in many cases they're indigenous or peasant people with a very close relationship to their land, but also where resettlement happens, where there actually is an attempt to account to people that are going to be displaced and actually try to assist them to recover their living standards, it very often fails. Time after again, you see that it doesn't work because a number of reasons. One thing is corruption. We see this with the Three Gorges Dam in China, many of you are aware of, whereby a third of the total project cost is supposed to go to the people being evicted. It's a huge amount of money, but that money goes from the central government down to the provincial government, down to the local government, down to the cities and lower levels. Everybody at each level is taking their little skim. So by the time it gets to the family, it's actually supposed to get it. It's maybe only a third of what they were supposed to get. Other problem is many people aren't even entitled as eligible for resettlement, even when there is a resettlement plan. This is often the case, for example, with people who don't have formal title to the land. So indigenous people in many parts of the world have been using land for generations, but don't have bits of paper to say that they are the actual owners of that land. And often without a piece of paper to say you're the owner, you don't get any compensation money. Then when compensation is provided, it very often proves inadequate because it doesn't cover enough things. Things like, for example, fruit trees may not be covered for compensation, or grazing land may not be covered. It may only be actual cropland, and often there's problems with the measurement of cropland. So you go through an amazing sequence of different ways in which people are basically suffering is caused by large-scale evictions. There's also the people that are affected downstream by the loss of resources downstream. The most obvious example is fisheries. It's health impacts, waterborne diseases, especially where you have irrigation projects. And generally, it's the already disadvantaged who suffer most, often because these are people, by definition, already the least politically powerful, so are least able to stand up to the state and prevent the project from being implemented, or to be able to stand up and actually get what may be their right. Women also very often suffer worse than men because often they're not recognized as being heads of households. So where you have a compensation plan, compensation will only be paid out to the men and the women don't get anything. Where you have cash compensation, you can have a very poor family, which is suddenly offered what seems to them a very large sum of cash for their land. They never have seen anything like so much cash before, so the men take the money and buy a motorbike or a TV and go and drink it. And very quickly, the cash is gone, as people don't have experience with handling such amounts of cash. These are some pictures I've taken over the years, different examples. This is in the Narmada River in India. Some of you may have heard there's been this epic struggle going on now for more than 20 years, trying to stop a series of huge dams, or at least get decent compensation resettlement for the people being moved. These are some of the original villages right beside the dam, and this is where people get moved to. These are terrible tin houses in the plains areas, where on the resettlement sites you see much higher levels of morbidity and mortality, the sickness and death. You see much higher rates of malnutrition, social indicators decline, alcoholism goes up, debt levels go up. This is also in the Narmada Valley, just showing some of the other impacts, people that normally don't get compensated. These are sand quarriers. People make their living from mining sand in a small-scale way from tributaries of the main river. And in large projects like India, you can have thousands of people like this who just don't exist in government records. Boat people, where you have a project that diverts water out of the river, you dry up the river downstream very often, you no longer need boat people, or you create a large reservoir where traditional boats are no longer safe and you have very high rates of drowning. This is from Thailand, Pak Mun Dam. This is the fish ladder of the dam, and this guy was known in the local community as the king of fishers, and he was held in very high regard in the community because of his knowledge off the river and where the fish species bred and what their life cycles were and which type of fishing gear to use to catch which fish. The dam was put in and the rapids were dynamited and the migration was blocked. The fish ladder proved to be totally ineffective. There wasn't even any water in it, never mind any fish, and so this guy is basically, you know, sort of the end of his usefulness to the community. So not only do you have these very severe impacts when you aggregate them worldwide, you also have very poor technical and economic performance. And you see time and time again, you see that the promises that are made for the projects don't actually turn out when the projects are built. You see very high cost overruns. You see failure to generate as much hydropower as promised, or failure to produce as much food through irrigation or irrigate as much land. The projects haven't provided as many benefits as has been projected. They do certainly provide benefits. And 12 to 16% of food production is much lower than would be perceived from reading the writings of the pro-dam lobby that will imply that large dams are essential for feeding the world. But it's still, that's an important amount. Of course, that's an important amount of food production. 20% of the world's electricity is an extremely important contribution to our total electricity. But with flood control, the issue is rather different, and there's no global statistics on this, but I think it's very likely that worldwide, the cumulative impact of dams has been to make floods and flood damage worse rather than to control them as they're supposed to do. There's a number of reasons for that. The most significant one probably is just the issue of giving a false sense of security, so that when a dam is built and people downstream are told, okay, now you're protected from floods, we've got the dam now, there's then a lot more development of the floodplain, but the dam cannot hold back every flood, and eventually you'll get a very large flood, the dam won't be able to hold it, and the damage downstream will be much worse than it was before. The issue of safety, dam failure, dams do collapse. The modern dams are definitely becoming more safe. The engineering standards are increasing. Engineers are understanding better how to build safer dams. But the stock of dams we have is aging. The maintenance costs are rising. And in this country, the U.S. Association of Civil Engineers reckons maybe $30 billion to keep U.S. dams safe is going to be the same around the rest of the world. In the US now, if there was a concerted effort to make dams safe, we would have the money, we could do it. Many other countries, that money is just not available. And over time, we're going to see many more dam collapses. It is inevitable, and especially because of climate change. I'll say a bit more about that later. Other problem is, while dams are often seen as being renewable energy, in many senses they're not. Where you have a large storage dam which is filling with sediments is basically not renewable unless you can think of some scheme to deal with the sedimentation. Dealing with sedimentation is extremely expensive, so generally it doesn't happen. So the World Bank's estimate is 0.5 to 1% of global reservoir capacity lost every year to the sediments that inevitably flow down rivers, and when they hit the reservoir they settle out to the bottom. And taking the average size of a new reservoir that's built, it would take 240 to 480 new projects just to maintain existing reservoir capacity. So as we get through this century, I mean, we've built this huge stock of dams in the 20th century. As we get, especially into the middle of this century, we're going to face a lot of problems of where societies, cities have become dependent upon nearby dams, and not always nearby, but they've become dependent on dams and reservoirs. And when those projects start to fill with sediment, it's going to be a major, major problem. So what has happened with large dam construction? Well, for someone with my perspective, it looks pretty good. Construction peaked in the 1970s. We had basically started to boom, you know, the post-war, after the Second World War, with the spread of large dam building technology to developing countries from US and USSR and Europe, and then a rapid increase through the 60s and 70s, but then it peaked and it's been coming down pretty sharply since then. But why is it slowing? Well, first of all, opposition from dam-affected people. It's now getting to the point where it's very hard to build a large destructive project without there being opposition in some form. And there's very few countries where the government is so repressive that they're able to stop that opposition happening. I can think of really Iran is probably the only country in the world that has a significant dam building program where we are not aware of at least some group that are trying to stop dams being built. The World Commission on Dams, I'll talk about later. Lack of funding, privatization, as many of you will know, over the last, especially last decade, there's been this concerted push internationally, and especially through the US government and some European governments and through the World Bank and other aid agencies, to promote the privatization of water and energy sectors. And I mean, it's happened in many countries, developed and developing. The large dam industry, when this trend started, was very excited because they saw that basically public money was drying up because such huge debts had been built up in the 60s, especially 70s, building these huge dams, early 80s, that government budgets, well, governments were starting to find it very difficult to find the money to build more of these big projects. It was becoming more expensive to build them for a number of reasons, including there was more opposition, so more money needed to be put into compensation to try and give people a decent deal. So the dam industry then thought, well, great, the private sector is going to come in, and so we'll see a new renaissance in dam building. Didn't happen at all. Quite the opposite happened. The funds dried up even more quickly, and that's very largely because of the extremely high economic risks involved in building dams. And while the dam industry believed that this was cheap electricity and cost-effective and least-cost options, when the private sector took a look at it, they realized that actually they saw these projects were not providing the benefits that they were supposed to, and that there was huge upfront costs and huge cost overruns, so they're very nervous. So there have been some big dams built around the world with private money, but very few. Also, just decision-making systems have got better. This is what happened in the US, what really started to stop the rush to build dams in every single stream and river all over the US was the requirement that developers had to do environmental impact assessments and had to release more information. And as there was more public participation in the decision-making process, it got harder and harder to build the project. Improving viability and awareness of better options, improving awareness that actually there are other ways of getting these services. Yes, we need irrigation. Yes, we need flood management. Yes, we need electricity, but we can do it in other ways. Also, interestingly happened is a stabilization reduction in water use. In the US, surprisingly, the total water use has fallen since it peaked in the late 70s or early 80s. It's fallen about 20% from its peak. And that's largely because of efficiencies in cities have become more efficient at using water, and industries become more efficient, to some extent, agriculture. So you heard me talking all these terrible, awful things about dams are the worst thing in the world. And so, you know, what is the position of large dams critics in this movement within which I work? It's not to say that all dams are incredibly bad ideas. And it's not to say that no dam should ever be built. But it is to say that many of the dams that were built should not have been built. And even those ones that you can make a case that should have been built were the best option were incredibly poorly planned and implemented. And so our position is that in future, water and energy planning should be done in a way that's compliant with the World Commission on Dams. And that means, most importantly, it should be transparent, it should be participative, so the public should be involved in it. There should be a comprehensive options assessment so that before you assume that a dam is needed in a country or a region, you first of all look, well, what are the needs to be met? And then what are the options for meeting those needs? And many cases it's happened where you have a good options assessment, you see that, you know, water saving technologies, for example, may make the dam unnecessary, maybe much cheaper, or a flood management plan that allows move some people out of harm's way in the floodplain and provides a better flood warning system is going to be more effective than building a dam. The other very important part of the WCD is it says that when there is a decision that a dam is the best option, that there should be negotiated agreements with affected communities. So that basically forced resettlement, forced evictions should not happen anymore. That if you're going to deprive people of their homes, lands, livelihoods, that you should make a legally binding commitment to improve their living standards and to actually negotiate with them. Which doesn't seem, I don't think, a particularly radical thing, but that you should actually negotiate with people when you're going to kick them off their lands, but the dam industry is rather horrified at the thought. This is the World Commission on Dams report. This was an independent commission, was sponsored by the World Bank and IUCN, a big international conservation group. People involved came from all sides, so the commissioners, people involved in selecting the commissioners were from governments, from the dam industry, from groups like ourselves. I was personally very involved in lobbying for the commission to be established and then providing input for the commission and helping to coordinating non-governmental organizations, civil society groups, community groups, and so on around the world to make submissions to the commission. And the report came out 5 years ago. And the mandate was basically to review what have dams done and what would alternatives be, and then also to look at how should water and energy planning be done in the future. There's actually a very good, well, I've only skimmed it, but it looks like a very good book has just come out on the World Commission on Dams by an excellent writer called Jacques Leslie, who lives in the Bay Area. It's called Deep Water. It's published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. It's just published, and he actually makes what could be very dull commission, bureaucratic blah, blah. He makes it really come alive. He follows three of the individual commissioners. And so what have been responses to the World Commission on Dams? How far are we getting in our demand that the future water and energy planning processes should be compliant to WCD? Well, not surprisingly, the report was very critical of large dams. It said, yes, they have provided benefits, but often those benefits were at an unacceptable cost. And so the response from the dam industry has been very hostile to the report. So these acronyms are all dam industry associations. The World Bank, even though it sponsored the commission, has been very hostile to it and has tried to discredit it. And then some of the main dam building governments have been very hostile, often in very much encouraged by the World Bank. But there are some successes. And first of all, civil society groups, so people affected by dams and activists working on dam issues and water and energy justice issues are very much in favor of the report and see it as providing this really progressive framework for development planning of all types in the future. But also some successes with the European Union, some European Union big public banks. This is a big private bank. There's a US government agency overseas private investment corporation, and they have all adopted all or some of the WCD policies into their own guidelines and policies and legal frameworks. And then another thing we're working on at the minute, which has been very interesting, is trying to work in different countries to bring governments and environmentalists and dam-affected people's groups, to dam industry together, and have them to actually discuss, okay, we have this report, what would this mean in this local context? And in some places, this has been very successful. Other places, less so. It's obviously difficult. You know, a place like Vietnam is a very repressive government. It's really hard to have an open discussion, but at least some progress has been made. So where's this got us to now? Well, we're now feeling, we've seen, you know, I showed you the slide with this steep decline in dam construction, and we've had this growing movement around the world that's been fighting against dams sort of on the ground and in the river valleys and capital cities, and people like myself lobbying internationally. But we now see a concerted backlash against that. Again, it's led by the World Bank and these industry associations. And the World Commission on Dams was quite a shock to the industry. They had their people, they had this retired head of this organization, ICOL, the main dam industry association, was on the commission. They thought that he would be a safe pair of hands for them. But he was a very interesting gentleman. He lives in Skokie, Illinois. He's originally from Holland, and he'd spent his whole life building dams around the world. He'd been involved in building many of the most controversial, what he saw as most beneficial dams in the world. When he got in this commission, he actually went out with the commissioners and visited dam-affected communities and went to villages that had been displaced by dams he'd built 30 years before, found out they still didn't have any drinking water. And he was really changed by the experience. So the dam industry was extremely disappointed by him. So anyway, this was a shock to them, and now there's this backlash, which is the sort of intellectual background for it is this World Bank water policy, which came out a couple of years ago. And the main arguments are to promote what it now terms high reward, high risk, hydraulic infrastructure, which means big dams. And it says that the easy and cheap options have mostly been exploited, so we got to do the difficult, expensive, risky things. Our argument would be the total opposite, that there are huge unexplored options which are much easier and cheaper in dams, much, much better. There's already been far too much emphasis being on the big projects for numerous reasons of political economy, and that we should not be promoting high-risk projects. We should be promoting low-risk. We should be promoting high-reward, low-risk projects. The justifications for this backlash, the issue of so many people don't have access to water and power in the world. We need to increase food production. Already we have so many people that don't have access to a decent food. We have a growing population, huge poverty around the world, and need to promote development. And now also the new justification is mitigation, adaptation to climate change. Mitigation meaning reducing emissions, basically, and adaptation meaning being able to deal with the changes as they come along, lessen their impact. However, there is no way, absolutely no way, that focusing on a new generation of huge dam mega projects is going to meet the needs of the very poorest and the people who currently don't have water and energy. It is not even going to make a significant impact in increasing food production. Number of reasons for this. Most obvious thing is that the great majority of people who don't have access to water and food are in rural areas. They're poor people living in rural areas, especially in Africa and South Asia. And there's no way that they can be reached with a huge complex of dams and pipelines and water treatment plants and pumps and so on. It's just absolutely no way that that's affordable or doable. It's not going to happen. But there is a huge potential for reaching these people with decentralized, low-cost methods, simple pumps, rainwater harvesting techniques I'll get into later. It's quite possible to meet the needs of these people, but it's not going to be done if all the resources put into water development are put into huge projects. And in fact, by putting all the money into those huge projects, you're just going to make it more difficult to get water to the people that need it most, and you're also going to have these very serious impacts on ecosystems. And often we think of ecosystems in this country, we think of, you know, cutting a forest and the loss of species, the loss of a beautiful place to hike. But in developing countries, a large percentage of the population is dependent on ecosystems for their survival. So when you destroy the ecosystem, you destroy the river downstream of a dam, you wipe out the livelihood of very many people. There is a revolution going on in the energy sector right now. It's happening too slowly and it's very late, but it is happening. And we see now around 2003 or so, the amount of new additions of wind power overtook large hydro for the first time ever. It's very hard to project where large hydro is going. It's actually much easier to project wind, but very likely large hydro will never again catch up with wind in terms of new capacity. Solar is starting from a very low base and is still lower than large hydro, but potentially 2007, 2008, 2009 in there, we'll actually see more solar being installed around the world than large hydro. And this is renewable energy put together, so it's solar, wind, small hydropower, geothermal, biomass, and also what's called cogeneration, so plants where you produce both heat and power out of the same plant, so it's much, much more efficient than conventional power plants. So it may still be based on fossil fuels, especially natural gas, but it's much more efficient than conventional, much cleaner than conventional sources. So there's some optimism there, and because of these technological developments, large hydro perhaps getting left behind. The issue, you go to big international water conferences and events where the World Bank has a presence, is promoting its policies. You often hear the promotion of, two main things in their agenda. One is promoting big water mega projects, the high risk, high reward projects. And the other thing is promoting private sector involvement. Now, both of these things have been a failure in terms of their ability to meet the poor. The involvement of the private sector is perhaps most in water supply has perhaps been the most striking failure. And the World Bank is now backing away from that. It's starting to admit the failures, but it's turning a super tanker. It takes a long time for them really to change their policies. But a figure is often put out there sort of to justify this approach, which is we need $125 billion a year if we're to provide the water needs of the world. Well, first of all, they'll say there are these billion people who don't have access to clean water. Then they'll say to meet the water needs of the world, we need $125 billion a year. Current spending, $75 billion. So they say we need an extra $50 billion. Governments don't have an extra $50 billion, so we need the private sector to come in. This is tosh. It's total nonsense. First of all, we've seen now the private sector is not coming in. The private sector has very little interest, actually, in providing water supply, especially in developing countries, and especially in rural areas in developing countries, because the people are extremely poor. A billion people living on less than $1 a day. They don't have money to pay for the profits of the water companies. So In most places, the water companies in developing countries are just not investing. But in any case, we don't need that huge amount of money. If you only take the actual needs of basic affordable water and sanitation, according to Vision 21, which was a United Nations process involving a lot of people working in small-scale water supply projects, they estimate that with $9 billion a year, you could provide water to everybody in the world who doesn't have it now, plus all the people going to be born over the next 20 years. Now, most of the poor and hungry people in the world, as I said, they're rural people. The great majority of them depend on rain-fed agriculture. The only way that we're going to make a serious dent in acute extreme poverty around the world is if we raise the incomes of small farmers in rain-fed areas. These people, the great majority, are not in areas that can ever get water from irrigation projects, because big irrigation projects, because they're up in hillsides, they're not close to major rivers. Most of the easy options to expand large-scale irrigation have already been taken. It's extremely expensive now to expand large-scale irrigation. There's very few lands that are really suitable for irrigation that are still waiting to be developed, and especially ones with suitable water that could be brought to them. So we got to raise rain-fed yields of crops in rain-fed lands, and that's going to happen with improving agricultural techniques on rain-fed lands, and it has nothing to do with building big dams or large-scale dam and canal irrigation projects. And one of the most interesting technologies is this huge potential and is now getting a lot of attention around the world is what's called rainwater harvesting. There's many different forms of it. These photographs are from Rajasthan, the desert state in northwestern India, where some of the most admirable and now well-known work in rainwater harvesting is being done. And this is an area around 600,000 people where about 1,000 villages of people are building. You can just see at the end here an embankment. People build these embankments across seasonally flooded streams. Streams just get flooded during the monsoon season. And then they trap water. They don't use the water directly from the pond they create. They very rarely use it. They allow that water to recharge the groundwater. And then they use the water from wells. And this has totally regenerated this area. It's incredible to go there and see what has been accomplished. This area, which was incredibly poor, deprived area with a huge water shortage. They had problems. Young men wouldn't come to the villages to marry women there because the villages were known in that region for being so poor and because they just didn't have a supply of water or they very unreliable water. Now the area has been really changed. So this guy, for example, he's growing tomatoes, exporting them to Delhi. They'd never been able to grow tomatoes in that village before. In India, a very valuable crop. So it can provide huge benefits, and it's not just in rural areas. It can also be done in cities, and it can be done in the developed world, and it's actually quite common on farms in the U.S. You see all sorts of little farm ponds are basically a form of rainwater harvesting. Texas, somewhat surprisingly, has got some really interesting urban rainwater harvesting programs, catching rainwater in the roofs of buildings to be used in irrigation nearby and so on for landscaping. Rainwater harvesting is affordable. It's an incredible amount cheaper than the conventional high-risk, high-reward option. This is just an example, a dam and pipeline in Botswana in southern Africa, providing water $500 a person. Here's some rainwater harvesting examples, a fraction of the cost. That example, my last slide from Rajasthan in India, an Indian friend and myself calculated the costs there where for irrigation water, the costs were around 1% of the cost of the big dam and canal scheme being built in the Narmada River, the really controversial scheme. In terms of, it was either water supply was a hundredth of the cost and irrigation was a 360th of the cost, or possibly it was the other way around. But the point is, a tiny fraction of the cost. So the same amount of money that had been spent on this one big dam scheme, which is supposed to bring water to 30 million people, but it's very, very, very doubtful it ever will. With that same amount of money, you could provide water for the entire population of India, over 1 billion people. Now, the sort of new justification for big dams is that they're climate friendly. We do desperately need to cut greenhouse gas emissions. We have an absolute crisis because of global warming. There's no doubt, and this is an issue that needs to be considered when power options are being considered, and certainly we don't want to stop a hydropower project being built and have a coal plant built instead. But one thing which needs to be taken into account is that there are emissions from reservoirs because of the vegetation and the soils that rot when the land is flooded. And importantly, it's not just the trees you see here that die when the reservoir is created, but it's all the vegetation that comes floating is washed by the river into the reservoir over its life. It's also the rotting of vegetation that grows around the reservoir. And when the reservoir is drawn down in the dry season, you get a lot of growth around it. And then when it comes up again in the wet season, that vegetation is flooded and rots. And the main impact is in the tropics, where the emissions from large tropical reservoirs can be extremely high, and even much higher in some cases than fossil fuel alternatives. Methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. It's 24 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. and you can get very high emissions of methane due to the rotting of biomass in the bottom of tropical reservoirs. Now, it's a very controversial, complex issue. There's scientists that are funded by the hydropower industry saying the impacts are relatively low, and what independent scientists say, no, they're relatively high. But some examples, this is from a team in Brazil that received their funding from the Brazilian hydropower industry and basically are seen as generally sympathetic to hydropower. And these are the emissions of hydropower. These are what the emissions would be of a natural gas combined cycle, so the efficient modern natural gas plant, so clean or cleaner fossil fuel equivalent. So you see in some cases, these projects here, four out of the projects they looked at, that actually the emissions from the hydropower are higher than the natural gas, in some cases significantly higher. In other cases, the other way around, where you have a powerful dam but a small reservoir. Basically, you have a very good dam site with a narrow canyon. The emissions from hydropower will be much less. But this is from the independent scientist, Philip Fernside, who works out of Manaus in the Brazilian Amazon. His calculations of the emissions from Brazilian dams are that the hydropower emissions are much higher. The case of Balbina, rather a tourist project right in the middle of the Brazilian Amazon, the impacts are something like 30 times higher even than a coal plant. It's quite astounding. So the other issue is adaptation. We need to adapt to climate change. One of the biggest impacts we're going to see from climate change is going to be on our water resources. It's not going to be just that we're going to have more heat waves, although we will have that and that will be serious. It's not just rising sea levels, some of the more maybe better known things, but it's going to change the hydrological cycle, and that's going to make water management very difficult. One impact is going to be where you have greater droughts, you're going to have reduced power generation. Now, this is obviously happening in the Colorado River. Whether or not this drought is going to last, we don't know, obviously, whether or not we're going to see a lot more droughts like this. But predictions are that we will, and modeling of impact of climate change in the Colorado is that we will see pretty large reductions in stream flow, so that's going to mean much less power generation. Also can mean increased sedimentation, because a lot of areas will have basically shorter bursts of more intense rainfall. And when you have a drought and you have dieback of vegetation and then you have very intense bursts of rainfall, you get much higher erosion than in an area where you have more better soil coverage. So that presumably will increase sedimentation of reservoirs. But one of the biggest issues is safety. You build a dam on the basis of the floods that historically you can say have happened in that watershed, and so you can calculate what's the worst possible flood you're going to get. But we don't know anymore, because we do hydrologies. We say this is a 1 in 100 year flood event, or 1 in 200 year flood event, or even a 1 in 10,000 year flood event. But we don't know now, because that's based on the presumption that you can look at past hydrologies and that's a guide to the future. But that's no longer the case. Hydrologies are changing, and we don't know how they're changing. We don't know how fast they're changing. Partly because we don't know the response of the climate system to the greenhouse gases we're putting into it, partly also because we can't exactly know how much greenhouse gases we're going to put into the climate system. And then we have things like feedback. Some of you will know recently about a lot of concern about the Arctic ice shrinking very rapidly, which means that because there's less white coverage in the Arctic, there's a lot less reflection of heat back, and so the ocean is dark and it absorbs more heat, and so you have this feedback. And there's many other frightening feedbacks like that. Also, riverine biodiversity, species in rivers are going to be affected by climate change. One thing they're going to need to do is to be able to migrate up and down rivers and to have a broad range of ecosystems that you have you're more likely to have, you will have more in an undammed ecosystem. You have a dammed ecosystem, you have blockages to migrations, and you have a much simpler ecosystem with many fewer diversity of different habitats, so it's going to be harder for aquatic species to adapt. What should we be doing? Reducing hydropower dependence. The hydropower industry will say that, well, developing countries have used much less of their hydropower capacity than developed countries, so therefore it's not fair that developed countries shouldn't build more hydropower. But in fact, many developing countries are extremely dependent on hydropower. Hydropower provides more than 50% of the energy in 63 countries. The majority of those are very poor developing countries, especially in Africa and Latin America, or so-called countries in transition, so former Soviet, former communist countries in Central Asia and Eastern Europe. What happens when you're very hydropower dependent is you're very drought vulnerable. So when a drought comes, your power supply will drop. And this is an increasing problem in many parts of the world. The best thing to do in terms of preparing ourselves for climate change is going to reduce our demand for water. So demand side management, reduce our need for both water and electricity, make ourselves as efficient as we can be. Recharging groundwater, managing groundwater, and stopping the overpumping, the mining of groundwater. Rainwater harvesting is going to be key. And flood management. Floods are going to get worse. We need to be prepared for that. We can't control floods. With the current climate, we know we can't control floods. Flood control has failed. We've got to manage floods. That means accepting that floods will happen, accepting that ecologically floods are not just beneficial, essential for ecosystems. But we got to get people out of harm's way when floods happen. We got to increase the resilience of places where people live to and the people that live there to deal with floods. So, what is the future of large dams? You know, on the one hand, we've got positive things happening, the World Commission on Dams and more enlightened policies for funding developing projects. We have got an increased attention from the World Bank to working with existing projects, making existing projects work better before we go and build new projects, and also supporting renewable energy and so on. But we also have this new World Bank promotion of huge projects, which they will say is because they want to solve poverty, help the poor people of the world. My interpretation of it is very largely because they need to lend a huge amount of money. The World Bank needs to lend $20 billion and up every year. It's very hard to lend a large amount of money in very small amounts. Basically, if you want to lend a lot of money, it's easier to do it in 100 checks rather than 50,000 checks. So the World Bank likes big projects. Governments also like big projects for a number of reasons, including political visibility and corruption. And so there is these, while the rate of dam construction has been declining, there are these huge projects that are being promoted in various parts of the world, much, much bigger than any dams or diversion schemes that have ever been built so far. Just one project in the Congo was a dam being very seemingly seriously talked about by African leaders that would generate 40,000 megawatts of power, which is about 20 times bigger than Hoover Dam, that'd be right. So what is, where have we been? You know, through the 20th century, we had a water ethos, which was the project was ever-increasing demand, whether that be for water or for energy or for water for irrigation, and then you build the projects to meet your projections of increasing demand. This little axiom was said a lot. Water flowing to the sea is wasted. Roosevelt said it, Stalin said it, people at the World Bank said it, Franco in Spain said it. It was this belief that if you didn't stop water flowing to the sea, it was a waste. And we did that to the Colorado and totally destroyed the Colorado Delta. Ecologically, of course, it's totally illiterate and insane. Water should be moved from water surplus to water deficit areas. So Southern California is water deficit, Northern California is water surplus, so we move water from one to the other. Ecologically, of course, both of them are just about water perfect. They have adapted to be, the ecosystems there are adapted to the type of rainfall they have, and we should need to, the belief floods should be eradicated, which has failed, doesn't work, and generally a belief in building big things. So where are we hopefully going? How might we sort of get out of this mess and be able to sustain human society and sustain healthy freshwater ecosystems? A lot of things I talked about that seems like these are happening, but we need to push them much, much harder, and we need to fight back against this backlash from the old water buffaloes. So here's more recent, so more detailed figures on what's been happening with large dams. You see a very sharp decline after 2000. Interesting, when the World Commission on Dams report came out, though I'm sure it's not, the connection can't be so clean. So a very rapid decline. So now only 50 large dams being built a year compared to at its height was something like 700. Now, I think this probably exaggerates the drop. I think it's probably poor data collection by the dam industry. This is a publication by the dam industry, but presumably the trend is right. But you also see at the beginning here, there's a little bit of a rise. And the big question now is that, is the trend go down to sort of near zero or stay 50 or so, and that's going to be the future of large dams? Or is this a ski jump? Is it going to go right up again? And that's what our organization will be working to prevent. Thank you. So, any questions, sir? Well, I would say if you look at the management of the Colorado Basin as a whole, I would say that it's a failure and that it shows many of the things that have gone wrong. First of all, assuming that there's much more water there than there actually is, so that everybody is fighting over a quantum of water which has not been there in the past and probably not going to be there in the future. I think the development patterns of Southern Nevada and Southern California are not something that, you know, if we really thought about sort of human well-being and sustainable development, that we would have a very different type of development pattern. So I think that as a whole, and of course we have destroyed species and indigenous species of fish that are extinct or going extinct, and we have the destruction of the Delta. So I think overall, many mistakes were made. Hoover Dam, I find an incredibly inspiring piece of engineering. It's an amazing structure, but I also think some of the things about it, I'm not really sure, like flood control downstream. I mean, there still are floods that have happened downstream. I mentioned in my book, there was a lot more money had to be spent on levees and other things downstream, partly because all the sediment was stored in Lake Mead. The water downstream is very clear, which means it's what's called hungry. It's very much more erosive, so it actually eroded away the bed of the river immediately downstream of the dam, then picked up all the sediment and then dumped it downstream around Needles. So there was a lot of flooding happened around Needles, actually, because of Hoover Dam. Well, Hoover Dam's not going anywhere. It's there. Glen Canyon Dam's a different thing. Now, many of you are probably aware there are a couple of organizations that are dedicated to the decommissioning of Glen Canyon Dam, and I think that would be an excellent thing. I think it's extremely destructive and actually unnecessary project. The question was, what was the impact of the Three Gorges project in China? But most significantly, resettlement of people. I mean, something like 1.3 million people that are being evicted with clearly a lot of hardship. I mean, the Chinese government was aware that there was a potential for a lot of civil unrest with so many people being moved, and they did devote a lot of money to the problem, but because of the corruption that I mentioned earlier and various other things, still a lot of people are very unhappy with what's happened, and there have been riots and protests of various types, but it didn't lead to the sort of widespread protests they feared. Ecologically, with Three Gorges Dam, maybe the biggest impact is going to be the impact upon the delta and upon Shanghai, and is there going to be greater sea lion intrusion, and especially is that going to affect the drinking water supply for Shanghai? Is it going to lead to greater erosion and subsidence in the delta area, like, you know, we've seen in the Mississippi and a lot of other deltas? It was such a huge project, there's many impacts and a lot of questions about its basic efficiency. You know, there's a lot of controversy over how successfully is it going to be able to deal with sediment, and especially how successfully is it going to be able to deal with floods. One of the main reasons was flood control, and it's unclear how much it's going to be able to reduce flooding. Now, it is going, no matter what happens, it's going to provide a lot of electricity. It may not generate as much as they've said, but it's going to generate a lot, and that's an important thing in China, where there's horrendous problems with coal burning generation. If it displaces coal, it's a good thing. But on the other hand, one of the purposes of the reservoir is to improve navigation so that ocean-going vessels can get all the way up to the city of Chongqing, which is about 1,000 kilometers inland or so. And a lot of what Chongqing produces is coal, so it's actually going to help getting coal out of Chongqing to downstream regions. So in some respects, not clear it's going to reduce coal burning. Sorry. So the question is, why would 1 million children a year be dying from wood smoke? It's because of lung infections, which are caused by breathing wood smoke from open stoves inside. So in kitchens where there's no oven, there's no chimney, and so mothers and children are subjected on a daily basis to a huge amount of smoke, and I'm not a medical expert, but the particles get in your lungs and make your lungs more susceptible to infection. Question is, a statement, sedimentation is going to have a really major impact on water resources, and then in a couple of hundred years, existing reservoir capacity will basically be gone. Yes, it absolutely is, and there is not nearly enough attention going into it. There are some things that can be done. I mean, one, the obvious thing is you can dredge, but dredging is extremely expensive, and to dredge a large reservoir would cost billions of dollars, and especially in developing countries, that money is just not there. And even in the U.S., to dredge a large reservoir like Lake Mead is just not feasible, because you got to get the sediment out of the reservoir, and you got to take it somewhere, and you got to dump it, and you got to have, you know, all the trucks in the world carrying all that sediment away. But for some smaller projects, say, you know, some water supply reservoirs around LA where the storage capacity is extremely valuable, and there it makes economic sense, and you can dredge the reservoirs. There are these techniques, like they're going to try at Three Gorges Dam, of the sluicing and venting, which are ways that basically, say, for part of the year, you allow the water, the river, to run as close to naturally as possible through the reservoir so that it mobilizes the sediment and supposedly carries it out. That can work to some extent, but there's various problems about it. It'll only work in reservoirs with a certain morphology, a certain shape and certain flow characteristics. Another thing is the great majority of sediment, in many cases almost all the sediment, comes in a few very large flood events. So if your reservoir is for flood control, the idea is that you close your gates when a big flood comes and you store that water. That means storing all the sediment. So there's an inherent contradiction there between allowing the sediments to pass in the flood and actually controlling the flood. And there's other problems, like when you're letting all the floodwaters pass, you just open up the gates of the dam and you're not generating electricity, and you're not storing water for the dry season, which is what the dam is supposed to do. So in some cases, there will be some dams where the sediment issue can be managed, but in general, worldwide, it's a huge problem that I don't think really has a solution. You know, we can get by a couple more decades before we really start to notice it, but in the middle of this century, I think for places like India, Pakistan, places that are very dependent upon irrigation especially, it's going to be a huge, huge problem. So the question is, what effect will it have on Iraq, of dam building in Iran and on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers? The problem there is actually not so much Iran, but rather Turkey. The Tigris and Euphrates both rise in eastern Turkey, and then they flow a little bit into Syria. But there is a big issue with the Tigris and Euphrates, and Syria has been extremely alarmed about Turkey's ability now to hold back the water that flows down those rivers. And Iraq protested a lot about it, but, you know, under the Saddam Hussein government, nobody really listened to them, so that wasn't seen as a serious thing. But now, with a pro-US government in Baghdad, possibly it's going to get harder for Turkey to build more dams. Turkey does want to build a lot more dams in the southeast of the country, and they're very controversial projects. And of course, yeah, the whole issue of Turkey being a NATO country and a big supposedly US ally as well makes it politics quite complicated. Like most countries, very nationalistic and says the water's theirs and they'll do what they want. Nobody's going to stop them. Question is, sorry, is it late? What we do. So International Rivers Network, based in Berkeley, and this is our 20th anniversary. We have a budget of about $1.35 million, and mostly money comes from big U.S. foundations, but we also have members, and if anybody would like to donate money or become a member, you go to our website, irn.org, and I would be very, very happy about that. We do a lot of work supporting grassroots, environmental, and community groups around the world.
Time for one more question.
In the last few years, the rate of dam decommissioning has overtaken the rate of dam construction. So the number of dams in U.S. rivers is now declining very slowly. And there's 75,000 dams if you include everything over 6 feet high. So there's an awful lot of them that are still there. But it's reversed in this country. I mean, there's a momentum going whereby with the dams that have been decommissioned and now studies are done to see what are the ecosystem impacts. And so far, every case I've looked at, all the cases that have been studied, I've looked at incredibly positive impacts. I mean, very rapid recovery of fish, migratory fish species. And it seems that communities around the projects that have been decommissioned are very happy about it. Also, the dams are getting very old. Most of the ones being decommissioned in this country are very small, old dams, and they're unsafe. And I mean, a lot of dams are involuntarily decommissioned, you know, and you get big floods, you can have a dozen or two small dams will get washed out in a major flood and nobody's looking after these things anymore. The big question is, are we going to see some of the much bigger projects decommissioned? And, you know, Glen Canyon is the really big one. There's also Hetch Hetchy, but there's also the dams up in the Pacific Northwest. Five big dams with decommissioning campaigns in the Pacific Northwest. Two of them have congressional approval and appropriations. They're in the national park and they will be removed, in the two dams in the Olympic Peninsula. There's three dams on the Snake River in Idaho and eastern Washington. The major political issue about, you know, is it possible to keep the dams there and also maintain the salmon run? And a lot of people think it's not possible, and ultimately those dams have to go. Under this administration, they won't go, but this administration won't be here forever, and I think that quite likely those dams will at some point go. In the rest of the world, in Europe, dam decommissioning is increasing, and I mean, this is in France. It's a good friend, worked on a great campaign in the Upper Loire, and not only did they stop what was at one point proposed to be 18 new dams, they stopped them getting built, and they got a couple of old dams removed, and they've had really good recovery of the salmon there. What's been very interesting for us also, dam decommissioning, is in Thailand. The picture where I showed you the old guy, the king of fishers, standing on the fish ladder at the Pak Mun Dam, partly because we brought some people from that dam over to a conference on dam decommissioning in the US. They went back and they demanded that dam be decommissioned, and they got the government to open the gates of the dam for 4 months of the year, the 4 months of main fish migration season. And it's sort of a partial decommissioning, and apparently it's had a hugely beneficial impact on the fish there. And then nearby to that dam, on the same basin, there was another dam that was built for irrigation, but the people that were supposed to get the irrigation didn't even want the project because it was built on top of a salt dome, and so they were getting saline irrigation water. And they protested like hell, and they stood in the reservoir and didn't allow the reservoir to be filled and so on. And finally they won, and they got the reservoir was filled, but they got the gates to be opened, and the dam was decommissioned. And we actually helped to organize the second international meeting of dam-affected people and their allies. And it was held in a village that was actually had been flooded by the dam and then was uncovered when they decommissioned the dam. So it was a nice symbol. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody.
You have been listening to Patrick McCulley of the International Rivers Network talk about waters, rivers, dams, and development, sustaining freshwater ecosystems, and meeting human needs in the 21st century. The talk was given at the Barrick Museum Auditorium in Las Vegas, Nevada, on October 17th of 2005. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.